Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today we're going to talk with the writer Robin Hemley. He's written several travel books. He's a travel writer drawn to obscure and intriguing places, enclaves, exclaves, and overseas territories among them. He journeyed far afield as he sought to understand what it means to belong to a nation, what it means to go outside the borders of that nation. And his book, Borderline Citizen, which is what we'll talk about today, redefines notions of nationhood through an exploration of the arbitrariness of boundaries, what it means to belong. Robin Hemley is author of numerous books, including How to Change History, Invented Eden, Reply All, A Field Guide for Immersion Writing, Turning Life into Fiction, and Do-Over, among others. He's won many awards for his writing, including a Guggenheim Fellowship and 3 Pushcart Prizes, as well as residencies at the Rockefeller Foundation's Bellagio Center and the Bolyasco Foundation, fine arts work in Provincetown, the McDowell Colony, and others. And we talked to him previously, a few months back, about the book How to Change History, and we've brought him back to the program. Robin Hemley, thanks for coming back.
Oh, thank you for having me. Really delighted.
So I encountered the new book, your latest book, How to Change History. You talked about that. Very interesting. But as I went back and made myself familiar with some of your previous books, I just had to talk about this one. This is from 2020, also published by University of Nebraska Press. So thanks for doing this. You tell a story in the prologue about rushing to get a seat on a plane. Your passport's about to expire. And then a very provoking question from a seatmate. Tell me that story.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't my passport, thankfully, that was about to expire, but my visa.
Oh, your visa. Yeah.
Yeah. I was actually going to an exclave, which I'll talk about what that is exactly, called Kaliningrad in Russia, to write about it for this book. It used to be part of Germany. It used to be Königsberg, Germany. But when the Soviet Union won against the Germans in that part of Europe, they claimed that city, kicked all the German survivors out, and made it a Russian city. But it's separated by, hundreds of miles from the rest of Russia, because it wasn't ever a Russian city. And I was really interested in going there. So to get to Russia, I had to get a visa. And visas, well, now it'd be impossible, but back then in 2013 or so, you could get one, but you could only stay a prescribed amount of time. You could stay as long as your airline ticket was valid, basically. So I was rushing back from Kaliningrad to Moscow to catch my plane, to catch a plane to Hong Kong. And I... And the plane was late, and we were circling Moscow forever. And finally, we landed, and I had to go through passport control. And I was sure I had missed my plane, but I just made it barely in time to get to Hong Kong. And I was just pouring sweat and just really exhausted. I sat down, relieved, and there's this guy across the aisle from me. And he just says, where are you from? And I said, America. He said, I'm from Ukraine. And this was before, the conflict in Ukraine now. But he decided he wanted to tell me all his political views. He didn't like Obama. He liked Putin. He liked the president of Iran, who was Ahmadinejad, who was very anti-Semitic. And then I just sort of kept quiet. And he said, so let me see your passport. And I gave him my passport, and he gave me his, though he said it wasn't a very interesting one. He said, mine was really interesting. And he said, so I want to ask you, are you a patriot? And I'd actually never been asked that question before, and it really set me to thinking sort of what is a patriot and what does that mean in terms of, my connection to not only America but to the rest of the world, because I've spent a lot of time traveling around the world Not as much as someone like Rick Steves, but I've spent a lot of time traveling, and I have friends all over the world. And so it really set me back thinking, am I a patriot or not? And what is the difference between that and, say, a nationalist? So I'll leave it there for the moment. Does that answer?
So that sent you on a journey of, a metaphorical journey, thinking about borders and nationhood and identity, right? So what was, so I guess this would be a good time to explain enclave, exclave.
So most of us know what an enclave is. It's and there are sort of enclaves that are unofficial, like say a Chinatown, for instance, in New York or San Francisco, is an ethnic enclave. But it's not. There's no international border or anything. It's just where people have settled from one place. There are, of course, international enclaves where. They are sort of a group, say an ethnic group, usually that's set apart from the surrounding territory internationally. But exclaves are extraterritorial bits of countries that are not connected to, say, the mother country. And I first got interested in exclaves when I was living in Bellingham, Washington. Very close to the Canadian border. And I kept hearing about this exclave of the United States, which was a part of the United States that was completely separated from the US. Of course, there are famous exclaves like Alaska and Hawaii, which are not contiguous to the US, but this was a little town called Point Roberts in British Columbia, which was closer to Vancouver than it was to any American city. And from Bellingham, as the crow flies, it was not that far away. But because you actually had to cross two international borders to get there. You crossed the international border at Blaine, Washington, between Canada and the US, and then you had to take this long circuitous route to this peninsula. Until you finally got to the border with Point Roberts, and it was right up against this Canadian town, but Point Roberts had something like only 1,500 residents. It's really just a village. You can walk it in not too, probably an afternoon, and there's a hard stop international border there. And I was really interested in this place, like what, who lived there, and how difficult was it to live there in a place where, in a village that is completely cut off from the rest of the U.S. So I determined to go there, and I did go there, and it was just a very strange place because when I went there, it was virtually empty, and that was because I think I went there during the winter the first time, and so almost all the houses were deserted. What's happened with Point Roberts is that it's basically most of the houses are owned by Canadians and they see it as a vacation spot. So that made it interesting too, that it was an American territory, but most of the houses are owned by Canadians. And like a lot of these exclaves, it was formed almost by accident when the maps were being made. The borders were being finalized between the US and Canada. At the 49th parallel, they kind of drew a line and then zigzagged a little around the Great Lakes, in the Great Lakes and some other places. But they cut off at the 49th parallel Point Roberts from the rest of the US. So that's kind of how it was made. And there were different times where they talked about possibly trading it for another territory in Canada, but they never did.
So I guess the original idea for the book was you're going to go to enclaves and exclaves on the national holiday day, right?
Yes.
It became more complicated than that. You decided to add more essays in to follow these themes, right, of borders and nationhood and patriotism. Go ahead.
I actually went to a couple other places that I didn't include in the book, and a couple other exclaves and enclaves. I went to a bunch of them around the world. I went to this one, Kaliningrad. I went to Point Roberts. I went to the most complex border in the world, which was between Bangladesh and India, where there were little pockets of international territory in each other's country, hundreds of them. They decided finally, after about 200 years of wrangling, or 150 years, to trade them and to absorb the other's territories into their own. And so there were a lot of those exclaves and enclaves that were fascinating, but I also made the book a little broader in that I wanted to think about notions in general, as I said, of patriotism, but also more broadly about belonging. What does it mean to belong to a nation, a family, even a neighborhood? And one of the things that I find interesting and makes me think about these notions is when I leave the country, and often when I'm sometimes I then feel more American, because like when I was in Singapore, I lived in Singapore for 5.5 years with my family, teaching at a university there, and being away from America made me not so much cut off, but it made me think about what it meant to be an American, because I was always being viewed as an American by others. So if something happened in the world that was relevant to America, some political thing or some upheaval, people would always talk to me as though I had something to do with it, whether positive or negative, when of course I was just an individual living my life. But at the same time, I was, and so that, you know, made me think very much about what it meant for me to, you know, in terms of my identity, and how that also affects my family too, because I have a blended family. My wife is originally from the Philippines, and so I spend a lot of time in the Philippines too, and I, you know, love that country is very much as well. And so there are all these different complexities that I'm always thinking about. And so I included a lot of that in the book as well.
Struck me, you have a brief essay talking about Singapore and trying to convince your wife to come. she'd come for visits, right? But you suspected one of the reasons she wasn't coming was because of the racism of some against Filipinos in Singapore.
Yeah, true. Our two daughters, our daughters were mostly with me in Singapore, but she works in, and we live also in Iowa City, and she was able to visit us for several months at a time. She had a flexible schedule, but she never really wanted to commit to staying there. And part of it, I think, was because of the way that Filipinos were often treated in Singapore as kind of second-class citizens, or actually not citizens at all in many cases. Singapore is a really interesting country, in that it has several different ethnic groups and several different languages that are official languages. So it has English as an official language, it has Malay, it has Tamil, which is an Indian language, and it also has Mandarin. So there are these four languages, four distinct ethnic groups, but there are quite a lot of Filipinos there. They make up a large minority, but they are often sort of treated in a way that is, yeah, I would say discriminatory. And so we would have some these uncomfortable encounters, sometimes with taxi drivers and other people, who would say denigrating things about Filipinos. So, I didn't blame her for not wanting to be subjected to that.
So you say that people would want you to explain everything, that America was doing, even though you're just one individual. I think we tend to do that, right? We tend to generalize. It makes things easier for us. But that can slip into stereotype and into, a very negative experiences.
Completely. And that's why I think that travel is a luxury and travel is a privilege. But the thing that has really made me a traveler and makes me happy that my family travels too is to see firsthand how other people live and what other people think. And because I think it's very easy within our own national borders to think that our concerns are the only concerns of the world or the only concerns that should matter. And I think that makes people narrow-minded. And so one of the things that I think made me really interested in exploring the world and exploring, more importantly, how other people think, not just how I think, was when I was in high school, in ju a junior in high school, and I was going to a high school in Tennessee, in Suwanee, Tennessee. And my social studies teacher, Mrs. Spaccarelli, would always talk to us about these issues that I'm bringing up in the book, like what's patriotism versus nationalism, and you should think about the way other people view the world. This was just at the end of the Vietnam War. It was 1975, so that was, front and center in our consciousness. But also, she got me interested in Mach UN, and we went to Nashville, or no, we went to Knoxville to attend a Mach UN meeting, and we were each assigned different countries. And I, or got to choose actually, I chose Saudi Arabia, which is about as far from who I am as you can get. I was raised in a secular Jewish household. But I chose Saudi Arabia because I wanted to learn a different perspective. And so I went to the Model UN, with representing Saudi Arabia. And it just so happened that that week, their king, King Faisal, was assassinated by his nephew. So they became like the center of attention in this Mach UN. And I remember that all these different kids who were representing different countries would sent notes to us in the Saudi delegation, notes of condolence. And the only one that didn't, of course, was Israel. And so I sent a little note to Israel and said, "Hey, don't you want to say anything?" And they said no. They were very antagonistic, and they didn't know I was Jewish, but they were really antagonistic. And I said to them, "Hey, we are just role playing here. We're not actually representing these countries. Shouldn't we let up a bit and maybe not make the same mistakes that our elders are making?" And they wouldn't hear it. But it really set me on a path of, trying to understand other people and not being caught only in my own narrow viewpoints, because I saw quite clearly, had they known I was Jewish, they might have lightened up a bit. But I wasn't going to tell them because that wasn't the point of this. The point was to actually see, how they would treat someone else,
Well, let's take a brief break. We'll come back with Robin Hembley. We're talking about his book, Borderline Citizen, that the subtitle is Dispatches from the Outskirts of Nationhood. More following this.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We have with us the writer Robin Hemley. We're talking about his book this hour from 2020 called Borderline Citizen, Dispatches from the Outskirts of Nationhood. Published, Robin Hemley, in 2020, very timely still today.
Thank you. But yeah, I think fortunately and unfortunately, it's very timely.
Exactly. So this idea of, generalizing, stereotyping, also learning these ideas of nationhood and patriotism, I guess it's inculcated in our culture. I want to get into talking about what idealized nationhood, the symbols of patriotism. And a good way into that is your visit to the Falkland Islands. Tell me about the Falkland Islands, and then they're taking their Britishness to the nth degree here.
Yeah, no, the Falklands was one of my favorite places that I visited, and also one of my favorite essays in the book. Back in 1981, I believe, or 82, there was a war between Argentina and Britain, sparked by the Falkland Islands. Falkland Islands lie off of the coast of Argentina, but have been British for 160, 70 years. But they've always been disputed. Argentina calls them Las Malvinas, and to the British, they're the Falklands. But in 1981 or so, the Falklands, the Falkland Islanders, and there are only about 3,000 of them, really wanted to, stay British. But the Brits were doing everything they could to get rid of the Falkland Islands. They actually even wanted to give them to Argentina, but the Falkland Islanders said, no, we are British and we're staying with you. And Britain actually even sent over its foreign secretary to try to convince the Falkland Islanders to separate, and offered them money, offered them all kinds of things, but they said no. And so to the Brits, they were a headache for a long time. And they were, it was expensive to try to protect them and everything. And they had this one ship that was supposedly protecting the Falklands. I think it was an ice cutter, and they decommissioned it. And as soon as they did that, Argentina, which was under a military junta at the time and suffering economically, they thought that they took this as a signal that the British government really didn't care what they did, so they invaded. And it's one thing to want to give away your territory, but when someone wants to take it, that's another thing. And all of a sudden, Margaret Thatcher, who was the prime minister, and everyone else was up in arms, literally, and said, no, we're going to send an expeditionary force and kick you out. This is ours. And that's exactly what they did. They fought a bloody but short campaign, which they won against Argentina. And ever since then, the Falkland Islands have been sort of proudly British. But still, if you asked your average person in London or anywhere else in England how much they cared about the Falkland Islands, chances are they'd say very little. They hardly even, maybe not even know where it is. But the Falkland Islanders care so much about being British that they even synchronize their nightly news to the British nightly news. So the 6 o'clock news that comes on in London, they delay in the Falklands until it's 6 o'clock there. And they have British phone booths, those classic, now obsolete red phone booths. They have pictures of Margaret Thatcher in every window and Union Jack. So I wanted to go there. So I went there. And it's really hard to get there. You can only go by either military plane from England or by a once a week flight from Santiago, Chile, and I took that. And so it leaves on a Saturday, and then you're picked up on a Saturday. And if you miss it, then you're there for another week. And I stayed there for the week and interviewed all of these people, many of whom who'd been through the war. And they're all super, super patriotic, if not nationalistic, about being British. And they even had had at that time, just a couple months before I was there, a referendum on whether they wanted to stay British. And it was about as exciting a referendum as one that would be held in North Korea. I mean, everyone knew the outcome. So it was, I think, 97 or 98% of the people who voted in it voted to stay British. And the only big question was, who were the few people who voted not to be British? And as luck would have it, sort of made the acquaintance for that week. One was an Argentine doctoral student named Ezekiel, who was there in the Falkland Islands studying, getting his PhD, studying Britishness. And to be an Argentine in the Falkland Islands, you have to be pretty brave or naive, because a lot of people just still hate the Argentines. And so I traveled with him because I thought, oh, he's going to have a really great perspective on this. And then the other guy was a young medical intern from London whose parents, who was not white. I think his mother was Indian, and maybe his father was from somewhere else. I can't remember, but in any case, and he had this mohawk, and he looked, very sort of non-traditional and everything. But he turned out to be a British royalist. He was a big supporter of the royal family, and so talk about stereotypes and such. He was super into Britishness. And so these were my two traveling companions for that week, and I was so fortunate to have them because they gave me this perspective that I as an American would not have had, because I didn't have a horse in the race, as they say. It didn't matter to me so much whether they were the Las Malvinas or the Falklands. But to these other people, it did.
And this is loving, I guess, pledging loyalty to an abstraction, right?
Completely.
This idea of Britishness is very important to them, and I guess the way we do that is through symbols, right? It's symbolic.
Flags and all kinds of things. I mean, we forget that nations are inventions. I mean, nations are made up. They're not these, they're not these God-given things. They are imaginary lines that we draw. And nations as we know them are relatively recent. In 1888, the French philosopher Ernest Renan delivered a famous lecture at the Sorbonne in Paris called "What is a Nation?" And it's a very simple question, but it was actually a kind of revelatory question at the time, because nations, as we know them now, were relatively recent. There had been empires, there had been these different countries, but they were not nations in the way that we see them now. For instance, Italy had only recently become a nation. Same with Germany. Australia was not yet a nation. India was still a collection of different feudal territories. So when he was asking what a nation was, he was saying, what is it that binds people together in this way that's not necessarily religious, that's not ruled by a king, that is founded on these ideals. And And he was not always, I mean, his assessment was not completely positive. You know, one of my favorite lines that he said was, if nations were people, if nations were people, they would be some of the most unpleasant people you could ever meet. They'd be obnoxious. They'd be people who were always talking about themselves, who were narcissistic, and so on. And when you think of it that way, and you think of the nations today that are constantly fighting and bickering and whatever, you have to think that in some ways he was right. But yeah, we're bound together. Another thing he said, which I find fascinating, is that nations are bound together not only by their victories, but by their defeats. And if that actually defeats make people more patriotic or nationalistic sometimes than victories. And you think of something like the Alamo, for instance, in our history. Remember the Alamo. And many, many countries have that too. So even battles can become symbolic and as sort of symbolic purveyors of what it means to belong to a nation. So it's flags, anthems, symbols, battles, a sense of history, shared history, all that.
And of course, this can be positive or negative, right? It can be a positive force, also could be negative. It seems like recently, the last few years, many politicians have been using this idea of nationhood in a kind of a, at least from my point of view, a negative way. It's yeah. us. It's us against the world. It
right.
Which can turn easily into it's us against anyone who's other within our borders.
Oh yeah, no, that's the most troubling, and it becomes. And there is a difference between patriotism and nationalism. Nationalism is the virulent form of patriotism, where it's exclusionary, where it's discriminatory, where it's it is that us against them idea. But a patriot can be someone who also loves the rest of the world and cooperates with the rest of the world. And a patriot isn't necessarily someone who is unquestioning of their country. You know, patriots, I mean, sometimes the most patriotic thing is to question, certainly in American history. And so the dangers, I think, were nationalism becomes virulent is when no one questions authority, when no one says, you know, is this the right thing to do? And especially when it comes to discriminating against other people and vulnerable people, because it's very easy to do. It's easy to do and to, you know, lose your sense of compassion for other people. And to say, you know, might makes right, or love it or leave it, or our country right or wrong. And that's when I think it's, you know, it becomes dangerous. But yeah, it can be very positive. I mean, like when I told you, when I go overseas, I feel probably the most patriotic in that if I find someone saying something about the U.S. that I think is untrue, or that's too simplistic, or is a generalization, I'm the first to defend the country, but not blindly. You know, sometimes people have fair points, and I agree with them. You know, and so I think that to me, being a patriot is a very complex position, because you have to constantly negotiate what that means to yourself and to your place among your community, because, and not just the larger community of the nation, but the community of the locale you live in, the community of your family, and so on. And it's all tied together to me.
So you have a quote to the beginning of the book from Hannah Arendt. I'm going to read this. Hannah Arendt says, "I've never in my life loved any people or collective, neither the German people, nor the French, nor the American, nor the working class, or anything of that sort. I indeed love only my friends, and only the kind of love I know of and believe in is the love of persons. This idea of nationhood and of patriotism could be positive or negative. Where do you come down on this? Love of nation, love of only of persons?
I mean, I'm more on Hannah Arendt's side. I mean, obviously, I put the quote at the beginning of the book, so I love Hannah Arendt. She was such a brilliant thinker, and I think she was provocative in many ways. But yeah, I have friends all over the world. When I think of my friends, I'm missing my friends constantly. I spent last semester teaching at the University of Iceland in Reykjavik, and I have all these Icelandic friends now who I love. And I have friends in Australia and friends in the Philippines and Hong Kong and Singapore. And I don't see those people as any less my compatriots, if you will, than my own people in the U.S. I don't feel close to everyone in the U.S. I don't feel that the U.S. that I feel that they're alienated, in fact, from great numbers of people who I think are not who don't really have the same idea of the value of the rest of the world that I do. So I think that my view is that my friends from all over the world are really, really important to me, and I would never sort of exclude them from my sense of belonging just because they're from other countries. And I would never privilege the U.S., frankly, over them. Obviously there are things that make me a U.S. citizen and will, always make me American, and proudly so. But they don't exclude other people.
If you just joined us, we're talking with the writer Robin Hemley. We're talking about his book, Borderline Citizen. We'll take another brief break. Come back with more following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams, and we're talking with Robin Hemley, talking about his book from 2020 called Borderline Citizen, Dispatches from the Outskirts of Nationhood. It's from University of Nebraska Press. It's available now, well worth the read. Robin Hemley, I think this might have been from the prologue. I'm trying to find it here. You talk about how you like the way Acadians think of nationhood, and Acadians don't really have a nation. So I guess that's maybe the whole point.
Well, yeah, Acadians were the French people who settled in what's Quebec and that whole area. And there was an early example of ethnic cleansing where the British basically forced them out. That's some of them were forcibly migrated to New Orleans in that area and are known as the Cajuns now, and they lost their nation of Acadia. But I met an Acadian author named Francois Engarde, and she said that they actually have an annual congress. An Acadian Congress, and they have a national anthem and a flag and all that, but they have no territory, but they still have that sense of nationhood. And I liked that what she said about it was that, you didn't have the sort of wrangling over territory. You didn't have the, killing and all of that that comes with people fighting as they're fighting now, after the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Killing hundreds of thousands of people over territory. And so it's something that is very idealized, and in a kind of abstract way, I like the idea of nationhood without the, you know, the territory, that the way the Akkadians think of it, because they're free of all that and they don't kill each other and they don't kill other people.
Want to talk about this idea of very complicated borders. And one of the most complicated places in the world is in the Netherlands and Belgium. I just want to read this from this essay called Don't Be Too Difficult. By the way, accompanied by a photograph of a house, which is half of it's in the Netherlands and half is in Belgium. I'll just read from the book Borderline Citizen. Perhaps the most unusual border town in the world, in and around Barlay, there are 22 pieces of Belgium situated in the Netherlands, 7 pieces of the Netherlands lying within Belgian exclaves, making them counter-exclaves. A solitary Dutch exclave lies across the greater Belgium border, several kilometers away from where I sit. Tell me about this place.
Yeah, so a lot of these on a lot of these exclaves were formed in medieval times when these were just feudal territories owned by princes and kings and so on, and the actual borders were not so solid or important. But as nations started to form, and borders got more hardened, then these territories became little pockets within other nations. So this Barlay-Hertog, Barlay-Nassau, is a really famous example in that the town really is this sort of split of international territories. And so you go there and they've marked the border in many, many different places where you're crossing the border. Of course, there's no, it's all part of the EU, so there's no border guards or anything. But you can take a stroll, as I did, in the evening, and walk through, maybe cross the international border, 20 times. And before the EU, this was always a bit of a problem because the Belgium and the Netherlands taxed differently. So there was a law about, for restaurants, for instance, where your cash register was the country that would get the taxes. So people would do all kinds of things to have their restaurants configured so that the cash register was in, I can't remember whether it was Belgium, which was cheaper, or the Netherlands, but they would make it so that their cash register was where it was cheaper taxes. And it was, and mostly those were the sort of things that were the difficulties that happened. But there was one really tragic case where which I write about, which happened in the 1960s. And it was really amazing. There was this guy who was riding a motorcycle, and he was with his girlfriend, and they were sort of playing with just sort of fooling around with the car in front of them, which had their friends. And at some point, the driver of the motorcycle lost control, and the motorcycle crashed and threw both him and his girlfriend into a ditch, into a field with a tree. I think he was killed instantly by the tree, and the young woman was injured very critically. So the first ambulance crew to arrive was a Belgian ambulance crew, and some guy, he should have just kept his mouth shut, but some guy in the Belgian ambulance crew said to the others, "Hey guys, isn't that where the accident happened? Isn't that over in the Netherlands?" And as soon as he said that, they were not able to actually go and help the couple because they didn't have authority. So they had to stand there and call and wait for a Netherlands ambulance to come. And it took all afternoon, and by that time the young woman had died. And she could have been saved, possibly, if that hadn't been the case. So that really changed people's thinking. And when I went to Barley Heritage in Nassau, you know, of course, things like that would not happen now because, as I said, they're all part of the EU, so those borders don't matter so much. But when that happened, so when I went there, I was introduced to someone at the tourist office who said he would take me around. He'd lived in the area of his whole life, and a very nice man. And he gave me a kind of tour of the place. And I sat down for coffee with him at one point, and I started telling him the story that I had heard about the motorcycle accident. And he got this really wide-eyed look on his face, and he just said, "Where did you hear that?" And I said, "What, is it not true?" And he said, "No, it's true, but that's not a widely known story." But and he said, "The reason I'm so surprised is because that was," he said, "that was my brother." And it turned out that that was indeed his brother who had been killed. And he told me the whole story about this, and told me the whole story of Barley Herzog and Nassau as well. During the World Wars, those exclaves became really important in fighting against the Germans, because they were used as places of smuggling and even of saving Allied, like downed pilots and people like that. So even this weird exclave of Barley, Nassau and Hertog had its upside as well. And now, of course, it's a big tourist destination.
Oh, we just have about a minute left. I wonder, just a takeaway. What do you hope people take away from this discussion, from the book about nationhood, belonging, borders?
Well, I just think it's good to understand as much as possible your own nation's history as deeply as possible, so that you understand where we've been and where we can go. Because I think a lot of times people have an imperfect understanding of their own history and even of their own civics, even their, you know, how the government works. I think it's really important to understand who we are as Americans, and our history and our relationship to the rest of the world, so that we can make better choices about our views of others who don't necessarily share our own views. You know, so that's part of the reason I wrote the book, was to not just, I'm not sort of preaching, but more to understand my own views of our nation and our history in relation to the rest of the world, and my own views of my own sense of belonging.
Well, there's much else in the book we didn't get to. You can pick it up from University of Nebraska Press. It's called Borderline Citizen: Dispatches from the Outskirts of Nationhood. Robin Hemley, the author, has been with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Appreciate it, Tom.
Thank you. And thanks, everyone, for listening to Access Utah.